aside. Sandoval decided after he came through mile 23.5 in 3 hours and 20 minutes. I'll save my strength and cream those guys when their tires go flat. He let Martin Manos Cervantes and Juan Herrera go, and almost immediately he was passed by Ann Trason. Where the hell did she come from? Ann should know better. This was crash and burn speed. At the 30-mile mark in Half Moon Campground, Martin Manos and Juan were ready for breakfast. Kitty Williams slapped thin bean burritos into their hands. They ran on, chomping contentedly, and were soon swallowed up by the thick woods around Mount Elbert. Anne raced in a few minutes later, pissed off and shouting, "Where's Carl? Where the hell is he?" It was now 8:20 in the morning, and she was ready to shuck weight by dumping her headlamp and jacket. But she was so far under record pace, her husband hadn't yet made it to the aid station. To hell with him. Anne kept her night gear and disappeared on the trail of the invisible Tarahumara. At mile 40, the crowd milled around the ancient wood firehouse in the tiny cabin village of Twin Lakes, checking their watches. The first runners probably wouldn't show up for another, there she is! Anne had just crested the hill. Last year, it took Victoriano 7 hours and 12 minutes to get this far. Anne had done it in less than 6. No woman has ever led at this point in the race before, said an incredulous Scott Tinley, the 2-time world champion Ironman triathlete who was doing TV commentary for ABC's Wide World of Sports. We're witnessing the most incredible demonstration of raw courage in sports today. Less than a minute later, Martin Manos and Juan popped out of the woods and came scrambling down the hill behind her. Tony Post of Rockport was so swept up in the drama, he didn't care for the moment that his boys were not only losing, but had also shit-canned the shoes he was paying them to wear. "It was the most amazing thing," said Post, once a nationally ranked marathoner himself, with times in the low 220s. "We were just flipping out, watching this woman take control." Luckily, Anne's husband was in position this time. He got a banana into Anne's hands, then ushered her into the little firehouse for her medical exam. All Leadville runners need to have their pulse and weight checked at the 40-mile mark, because shedding pounds too quickly is an early warning sign of dangerous dehydration. Only with Doc Perna's okay are they cleared to plunge into the meat grinder ahead. There, looming across the marsh, was the 2,600-foot climb to the top of Hope Pass. Anne munched the banana while a nurse named Cindy Corbin adjusted the scale. A moment later, Martin Manos stepped up on the scale beside Anne. "¿Cómo estás?" Kitty Williams asked Martin Manos, laying an encouraging hand on his back. "How are you feeling after nearly 6 straight hours of high-altitude hill running at impossibly fast speed?" "Ask him how it feels to get beat by a woman," Anne called out. Nervous laughter rippled through the room, but Anne wasn't smiling. She glared at Martin Manos as if she were a black belt and he was a stack of bricks. Kitty shot her an appalled look, but Anne ignored it and kept her eyes locked on Martin Manos. Martin Manos turned questioningly toward Kitty, but Kitty chose not to translate. In all her years of running ultras and pacing them for her dad, it was the first time Kitty had ever heard one runner taunt another. Despite what most people in the room heard, a video of the incident would later suggest that what Anne actually said was, "Ask him how it feels to compete with a woman." But while her exact words were debatable, her attitude was unmistakable. Anne didn't just win by running hard. She won by racing hard. This thing was going to be a death match. As Martin Manos got off the scale, Anne pushed past him and hurried out the door. She slung on her fanny pack, freshly loaded with carbohydrate gel, gloves, and a slicker in case she hit sleet or freezing winds above the timberline, and began trotting down the road toward the snow-capped mountain. She was out of there so fast, Martin Manos and Juan were still biting into slices of orange while Anne was heading around the corner and out of sight. What was wrong with her? The trash talk, the hasty exit? Anne didn't even take time to slip on a dry shirt and socks or get a few more calories down her neck. And why was she even in the lead at all? Mile 40 was only round 1 of a very long fight. Once you jump ahead, you're vulnerable. you surrender all element of surprise and become a prisoner of your own pace. Even middle school milers know that the smart tactic is to sit on the leader's shoulder, go only as fast as you have to, then jammer into gear and blow past on the bell lap. Classic example, Steve Prefontaine. Pre came out too quickly twice in the same race in the 72 Olympics. Both times, he was chased down. By the home stretch, Pre had nothing left and faded out of the medals to fourth. That historic defeat pounded home the lesson. Nobody gives up the pursuit position if they don't have to. Not unless you're foolish or reckless. Or Garry Kasparov. In the 1990 World Chess Championship, Kasparov made a horrible mistake and lost his queen right at the start of a decisive game. Chess grandmasters around the world let out a pained groan. The bad boy of the chessboard was now roadkill. A less gracious observer for the New York Times visibly sneered. Except it wasn't a mistake. Kasparov had deliberately sacrificed his most powerful piece in exchange for an even more powerful psychological advantage. He was deadliest when swashbuckling, when he was chased into a corner and had to slash, scramble, and improvise his way out. Anatoly Karpov, his by-the-book opponent, was too conservative to pressure Kasparov early in the game, so Kasparov put the pressure on himself with a queen's gambit and won. That's what Anne was doing. Instead of hunting the Tarahumara, she'd hit on the risky, inspired strategy of letting the Tarahumara hunt her. Who's more committed to winning, after all, predator or prey? The lion can lose and come back to hunt another day, but the antelope gets only one mistake. To defeat the Tarahumara, Anne knew she needed more than willpower. She needed fear. Once she was out front, every cracking twig would spur her toward the finish. To move into the lead means making an act requiring fierceness and confidence, Roger Bannister once noted. But fear must play some part. No relaxation is possible, and all discretion is thrown to the wind. Anne had fierceness and confidence to burn. Now she was deep-sixing discretion and letting fear play its part. Ultra running was about to see its first Queen's Gambit. Chapter 14. She's insane. She's awesome. Coach Vigil was a hard data freak, but as he watched Anne plunge into the Rockies with her ballsy do-or-die game plan, he loved the fact that ultra running had no science, no playbook, no training manual, no conventional wisdom. That kind of freewheeling self-invention is where big breakthroughs come from, as Vigil knew. And Columbus, the Beatles, and Bill Gates would happily agree. Anne Trason and her compadres were like mad scientists messing with beakers in the basement lab, ignored by the rest of the sport, and free to defy every known principle of footwear, food, biomechanics, training intensity, everything. And whatever breakthroughs they came up with, they'd be legit. With ultra runners, Vigil had the refreshing peace of mind of dealing with pure lab specimens. He wasn't being hoodwinked by a phony super performance, like the miraculous endurance of Tour de France cyclists, or the gargantuan power of suddenly melon-headed home run hitters, or the blazing speed of female sprinters who win 5 medals in 1 Olympics before going to jail for lying to the feds about steroids. Even the brightest smile, one observer would say of disgraced Wonder Girl Marion Jones, can hide a lie. So whose could you trust? Easy. The smiles on the oddballs in the woods. Ultra runners had no reason to cheat, because they had nothing to gain. No fame, no wealth, no medals. No one knew who they were or cared who won their strange rambles through the woods. They didn't even get prize money. All you get for winning an ultra is the same belt buckle as the guy who comes in last. So as a scientist, Vigil could rely on the data from an ultra marathon. As a fan, he could enjoy the show without scorn or skepticism. There's no EPO in Anne Trason's blood, No smuggled blood in her fridge. No ampules of Eastern European anabolics on her FedEx account. Vigil knew that if he could understand Ann Trason, he'd grasp what one amazing person could do. But if he could understand the Tarahumara, he'd know what everyone could do. Ann sucked air with deep, shuddering gasps. The final push up Hope Pass was agony, but she kept reminding herself that ever since the time Carl cursed her out, no one had beaten her on a big climb. About 2 years earlier, she and Carl were running on a rainy day when Ann began grousing about the endless, slippery hill ahead. Carl got tired of hearing her kvetch, so he blistered her with the most obscene name he could think of. "A wimp," Ann would later say. "The big W." Right then, I decided I was going to work to be a better hill climber than he was. Not only better than Carl, but better than everybody. Anne developed into such a relentless mountain goat that hills became her favorite place to drop the hammer and leave the competition behind. But now, as she approached the Hope Pass peak, she could glance back and see Martimano and Juan steadily closing the gap, looking as light and breezy as the capes that swirled around them. "God!" Anne panted. She was so hunched over, she could almost pull herself up the slope with her hands. "I don't know how they do it." A little farther down the mountain, Manuel Luna and the rest of Team Tarahumara were also catching up. They'd gotten scattered in the early miles by the startlingly fast pace, but now, like an alien protoplasm that reforms and gets stronger every time you blast it to bits, they were tightening back into a pack behind Manuel Luna. "God!" Anne exclaimed again. She finally reached the peak. The view was spectacular. If Anne turned around, she could see all 45 miles of tumbling green wilderness between her and Leadville. But she didn't even pause for a slurp of water. She had an ace in her hand, and she had to play it now. She was woozy from the thin air, and her hamstrings were screaming, but Anne pushed straight over the top and started chop-stepping downhill. This was a Trason specialty, using terrain to recharge on the move. After a steep first drop, the backside descent quickly softens into long, gently sloped switchbacks, so Anne could lean back, make her legs go limp, and let gravity do the work. After a bit, she could feel the knots easing in her calves and the strength creeping back into her thighs. By the time she reached bottom, her head was up and the glint was back in her cougar eyes. Time to fire the jets. Anne veered off the muddy trail and onto hard-packed road, her legs spinning fast and loose from the hip as she accelerated into the last 3 miles to the turnaround. Juan and Martimano, meanwhile, had gotten a little sidetracked. As soon as they'd broken past the tree line above, they were startled to see a giant herd of strange woolly beasts, and among them, some animals. "Soup's on, fellas!" a hoarse voice bellowed to the uncomprehending Tarahumara from somewhere inside the herd. The Tarahumara had just made first contact with another wilderness tribe, the Hopeless Crew. 12 years earlier, Ken Klober had mustered enough of his neighbors to staff a good half-dozen aid stations, but he refused to put anyone at the top of Hope Pass. Even the tough guy miner who delighted in his race's high hospitalization rate considered that inhumane. A volunteer on Hope Pass would have to haul enough supplies up the mountain to feed, water, and bandage an endless parade of battered runners, and then camp out for 2 nights on a snowy peak with gale-force gusts. Nothing doing. If Ken sent anyone up there, he'd have hell to pay when they didn't come back down. Luckily, a group of Leadville llama farmers shrugged and said, what the hell? Sounded like a party. They loaded their llamas with enough food and booze to make it through the weekend and hammered in tent stakes at 12,600 feet. Since then, the Hopeless Crew has grown into an army 80-some strong of llama owners and friends. For 2 days, they endure fierce winds and frostbitten fingers while dispensing first aid and hot soup, packing injured runners out by llama, and partying in between like a tribe of amiable yetis. Hope Pass is a bad son of a bitch on a good day, Ken says. If it weren't for those llamas, we'd have lost a good many lives. Juan and Martimano shyly returned high fives as they jogged through the raucous, hopeless gauntlet. They stopped to drink in the sight of the weird gypsy camp, as well as cups of some really tasty noodle soup someone shoved into their hands, then began quick-stepping down the backside of the mountain. Anne was nowhere to be seen. Anne hit the 50-mile mark at 12:05 p.m., nearly 2 hours ahead of Victoriano's time from the previous year. Carl loaded her up with sports drink and Cytomax carbohydrate gel, then snapped on his own fanny pack and gave his shoelaces a tug. According to Leadville rules, a mule can run alongside a racer for the last 50 miles, which meant Anne would now have a personal pit crew by her side all the way to the finish. A good pacer is a huge help during an ultra, and Anne had one of the best. Not only was Carl fast enough to push her, but experienced enough to take over if Anne's brain fritzed out. After 20 or so hours of nonstop running, an ultra runner can get too mind-numb to replace flashlight batteries, or comprehend trail markers, or even, in the unfortunate true case of a Badwater runner in 2005, distinguish between an imminent bowel movement and an occurring one. And those are the runners who are really keeping it together. Hallucinations are no strangers to the rest. One ultra-runner kept screaming and leaping into the woods whenever he saw a flashlight, convinced it was an oncoming train. One runner enjoyed the company of a smoking young hottie in a silver bikini who rollerbladed by his side for miles across Death Valley, until, to his regret, she dissolved into heat shimmers. 6 out of 20 Badwater runners reported hallucinations that year, including one who saw rotting corpses along the road and mutant mice monsters crawling over the asphalt. One pacer got a little freaked out after she saw her runner stare into space for a while and then tell the empty air, "I know you're not real." A tough pacer, consequently, can save your race. A sharp one can save your life. Too bad for Martimano, then, that the best he could hope for was that the shaggy goofball he'd met in town would actually show up and could actually run. The night before, Rick Fisher had brought the Tarahumara to a pre-race spaghetti dinner at the Leadville VFW Hall to see if he could recruit a few pacers. It wouldn't be easy. Pacing is so grueling and thankless, usually only family, fools, and damn good friends let themselves get talked into it. The job means shivering in the middle of nowhere for hours until your runner shows up, then setting off at sunset for an all-night run through wind-whistling mountains. You'll get blood on your shins, vomit on your shoes, and not even a t-shirt for completing 2 marathons in a single night. Other job requirements can include staying awake while your runner catches a nap in the mud, popping a blood blister between her butt cheeks with your fingernails, and surrendering your jacket, even though your teeth are chattering, because her lips have gone blue. At the spaghetti dinner, Martimano locked eyes with some long-haired local who, for some bizarre reason, immediately began cracking up. Martimano started laughing, too. He found the shaggy guy totally cool and hilarious. "It's you and me, brother," Shaggy said. "You follow? Two and yo. If you want a mule, I'm your man." Whoa, hang on," Fisher interjected. "You sure you're fast enough for these guys?" "You're not doing me any favor," Shaggy shrugged. "Who else you got lined up?" "Yeah," Fisher said. "Okay, then." And just as he'd promised, Shaggy was hollering and waving by the aid station the next afternoon when Juan and Martimano came running into the 50-mile turnaround. They took a long, cool drink of water and grabbed some pinole and thin bean burritos from Kitty Williams. Rick Fisher had also roped in another pacer, an elite ultra-runner from San Diego who'd been a longtime student of Tarahumara lore. The four runners traded Tarahumara handshakes, that soft caressing of fingertips, and turned toward Hope Pass. Anne was already out of sight. "Saddle up, guys," Shaggy said. "Let's go get the Bruja." Juan and Martimano barely understood anything the guy said, but they caught that all right. Shaggy was calling Anne a witch. They looked closely to see if he was serious, decided he wasn't, and started laughing. This guy was going to be a kick. "Yeah, she's a bruja, but that's cool," Shaggy went on. "We've got stronger mojo. You understand that? Mojo? No? Doesn't matter. We're going to run the bruja down like a deer. Like a venado. Yeah, a venado. Got it? We're going to run the bruja down like a venado. Poco a poco. Little bit at a time." But the bruja wasn't backing off. By the time she summited Hope Pass for the second time, Anne had widened her lead from 4 minutes to 7. "I was heading up Hope Pass, and she just blew by me going the other direction. Vroom!" a Leadville runner named Glenn Vassen later told Runner's World. "She was cruising." She threaded her way to the bottom of the switchbacks and plunged back through the Arkansas River, fighting to keep from being swept downstream in the waist-deep water. It was 2:31 p.m. when she and Carl arrived back at the Twin Lakes Fire Station at mile 60. Anne checked in, got her medical clearance, and trudged up the 20-foot dirt ramp to the trailhead. By the time Shaggy and the Tarahumara arrived, Anne had been gone for 12 minutes. Coincidentally, Ken Klober was just arriving at the Twin Lakes aid station heading outbound when Juan and Martimano came through on their return trip. Everyone in the firehouse was buzzing about Anne's record pace and ever-growing lead, but as Ken watched Juan and Martimano exit the firehouse, he was struck by something else. When they hit the dirt ramp, they hit it laughing. "Everybody else walks that hill," Klober thought, as Juan and Martimano churned up the slope like kids playing in a leaf pile. "Everybody. And they sure as hell ain't laughing about it." Chapter 15. The flesh about my body felt soft and relaxed, like an experiment in functional background music. Richard Brautigan, Trout Fishing in America. "Such a sense of joy," marveled Coach Vigil, who'd never seen anything like it either. "It was quite remarkable. Glee and determination are usually antagonistic emotions, yet the Tarahumara were brimming with both at once, as if running to the death made them feel more alive." Vigil had been furiously taking mental notes. "Look how they point their toes down, not up, like gymnasts doing the floor exercise. And their backs. They could carry water buckets on their heads without spilling a drop. How many years have I been telling my kids to straighten up and run from the gut like that?" But it was the smiles that really jolted him. "That's it," Vigil thought, ecstatic. "I found it." Except he wasn't sure what it was. The revelation he'd been hoping for was right in front of his eyes, but he couldn't quite grasp it. He could only catch the glim around the edges, like spotting the cover of a rare book in a candlelit library. But whatever it was, he knew it was exactly what he was looking for. Over the previous few years, Vigil had become convinced that the next leap forward in human endurance would come from a dimension he dreaded getting into, character. Not the character other coaches were always rah-rah-rawing about. Vigil wasn't talking about grit or hunger or the size of the fight in the dog. In fact, he meant the exact opposite. Vigil's notion of character wasn't toughness. It was compassion, kindness, love. That's right, love. Vigil knew it sounded like hippy-dippy drivel, and make no mistake, he'd have been much happier sticking to good, hard, quantifiable stuff like VO2 max and periodized training tables. But after spending nearly 50 years researching performance physiology, Vigil had reached the uncomfortable conclusion that all the easy questions had been answered. He was now learning more and more about less and less. He could tell you exactly how much of a head start Kenyan teenagers had over Americans, 18,000 miles run in training. He'd discovered why those Russian sprinters were leaping off ladders. Besides strengthening lateral muscles, the trauma teaches nerves to fire more rapidly, which decreases the odds of training injuries. He'd parsed the secret of the Peruvian peasant diet. High altitude has a curious effect on metabolism. And he could talk for hours about the impact of a single percentage point in oxygen consumption efficiency. He'd figured out the body, so now it was on to the brain. Specifically, how do you make anyone actually want to do any of this stuff? How do you flip the internal switch that changes us all back into the natural-born runners we once were? Not just in history, but in our own lifetimes. Remember? Back when you were a kid and you had to be yelled at to slow down? Every game you played at top speed, sprinting like crazy as you kicked cans, freed all, and attacked jungle outposts in your neighbor's backyards. Half the fun of doing anything was doing it at record pace, making it probably the last time in your life you'd ever be hassled for going too fast. That was the real secret of the Tarahumara. They'd never forgotten what it felt like to love running. They remembered that running was mankind's first fine art, our original act of inspired creation. Way before we were scratching pictures on caves or beating rhythms on hollow trees, we were perfecting the art of combining our breath and mind and muscles into fluid self-propulsion over wild terrain. And when our ancestors finally did make their first cave paintings, what were the first designs? A downward slash, lightning bolts through the bottom and middle. Behold, the running man. Distance running was revered because it was indispensable. It was the way we survived and thrived and spread across the planet. You ran to eat and to avoid being eaten. You ran to find a mate and impress her. And with her, you ran off to start a new life together. You had to love running, or you wouldn't live to love anything else. And like everything else we love, everything we sentimentally call our passions and desires, it's really an encoded ancestral necessity. We were born to run. We were born because we run. We're all running people, as the Tarahumara have always known. But the American approach, rotten at its core. It was too artificial and grabby, Vigil believed. Too much about getting stuff and getting it now. Medals, Nike deals, a cute butt. It wasn't art. It was business. A hard-nosed quid pro quo. No wonder so many people hated running. If you thought it was only a means to an end, an investment in becoming faster, skinnier, richer, then why stick with it if you weren't getting enough quo for your quid? It wasn't always like that. And when it wasn't, we were awesome. Back in the 70s, American marathoners were a lot like the Tarahumara. They were a tribe of isolated outcasts, running for love and relying on raw instinct and crude equipment. Slice the top off a 70s running shoe and you had a sandal. The old Adidas and Onitsuka Tigers were just a flat sole and laces with no motion control, no arch support, no heel pad. The guys in the 70s didn't know enough to worry about pronation and supination. That fancy running store jargon hadn't even been invented yet. Their training was as primitive as their shoes. They ran way too much. "We ran twice a day, sometimes three times," Frank Shorter would recall. "All we did was run. Run, eat, and sleep." They ran way too hard. The modus operandi was to let a bunch of competitive guys have at each other every day in a form of road rage, one observer put it. And they were way too buddy-buddy for so-called competitors. "We liked running together," recalled Bill Rogers, a chieftain of the 70s tribe and four-time Boston Marathon champ. "We had fun with it. It wasn't a grind." They were so ignorant, they didn't even realize they were supposed to be burned out, overtrained, and injured. Instead, they were fast. Really fast. Frank Shorter won the 72 Olympic marathon gold and the 76 silver. Bill Rogers was the number one ranked marathoner in the world for 3 years. And Alberto Salazar won Boston, New York, and the Comrades Ultra Marathon. By the early 80s, the Greater Boston Track Club had half a dozen guys who could run a 2:12 marathon. That's six guys in one amateur club in one city. 20 years later, you couldn't find a single 212 marathoner anywhere in the country. The United States couldn't even get one runner to meet the 214 qualifying standard for the 2000 Olympics. Only Rod DeHaven squeaked into the games under the 215B standard. He finished 69th. So what happened? How did we go from the leader of the pack to lost and left behind? It's hard to determine a single cause for any event in this complex world, of course, but forced to choose, the answer is best summed up as follows. Money. Sure, plenty of people will throw up excuses about Kenyans having some kind of mutant muscle fiber, but this isn't about why other people got faster. It's about why we got slower. And the fact is, American distance running went into a death spiral precisely when cash entered the equation. The Olympics were opened to professionals after the 1984 Games, which meant running shoe companies could bring the distance running savages out of the wilderness and onto the payroll reservation. Vigil could smell the apocalypse coming, and he tried hard to warn his runners. "There are two goddesses in your heart," he told them, "the goddess of wisdom and the goddess of wealth. Everyone thinks they need to get wealth first, and wisdom will come. So they concern themselves with chasing money, but they have it backwards. You have to give your heart to the goddess of wisdom. Give her all your love and attention, and the goddess of wealth will become jealous and follow you. Ask nothing from your running, in other words, and you'll get more than you ever imagined." Vigil wasn't beating his chest about the purity of poverty or fantasizing about a monastic order of moneyless marathoners. Shoot, he wasn't even sure he had a handle on the problem, let alone the solution. All he wanted was to find one natural-born runner, someone who ran for sheer joy, like an artist in the grip of inspiration, and study how he or she trained, lived, and thought. Whatever that thinking was, maybe Vigil could transplant it back into American culture like an heirloom seedling and watch it grow wild again. Vigil already had the perfect prototype. There was this Czech soldier, a gawky dweeb who ran with such horrendous form that he looked as if he'd just been stabbed through the heart, as one sports writer put it. But Emil Zátopek loved running so much that even when he was still a grunt in Army boot camp, he used to grab a flashlight and go off on 20-mile runs through the woods at night, in his combat boots, in winter, after a full day of infantry drills. When the snow was too deep, Zátopek would jog in the tub on top of his dirty laundry, getting a resistance workout along with clean tighty-whities. As soon as it thawed enough for him to get outside, he'd go nuts. He'd run 400 meters as fast as he could, over and over, for 90 repetitions, resting in between by jogging 200 meters. By the time he was finished, he'd done more than 33 miles of speed work. Ask him his pace and he'd shrug. He never timed himself. To build explosiveness, he and his wife, Donna, used to play catch with a javelin, hurling it back and forth to each other across a soccer field like a long, lethal frisbee. One of Zátopek's favorite workouts combined all his loves at once. He jogged through the woods in his army boots with his ever-loving wife riding on his back. It was all a waste of time, of course. The Czechs were like the Zimbabwean bobsled team. They had no tradition, no coaching, no native talent, no chance of winning. But being counted out was liberating. Having nothing to lose left Zátopek free to try any way to win. Take his first marathon. Everyone knows the best way to build up to 26.2 miles is by running long, slow distances. Everyone, that is, except Emil Zátopek. He did 100-yard dashes instead. "I already know how to go slow," he reasoned. "I thought the point was to go fast." His atrocious death-spasming style was punchline heaven for track scribes. "The most frightful horror spectacle since Frankenstein. He runs as if his next step would be his last. He looks like a man wrestling with an octopus on a conveyor belt." but Zátopek just laughed along. "I'm not talented enough to run and smile at the same time," he'd say. "Good thing it's not figure skating. You only get points for speed, not style." And dear God, was he a chatty Cathy. Zátopek treated competition like it was speed dating. Even in the middle of a race, he liked to natter with other runners and try out his smattering of French and English and German, causing one grouchy Brit to complain about Zátopek's incessant talking. At away meets, he'd sometimes have so many new friends in his hotel room that he'd have to give up his bed and sleep outside under a tree. Once, right before an international race, he became pals with an Australian runner who was hoping to break the Australian 5,000-meter record. Zátopek was only entered in the 10,000-meter race, but he came up with a plan. He told the Aussie to drop out of his race and line up next to Zátopek instead. Zátopek spent the first half of the 10,000-meter race pacing his new buddy to the record, then sped off to attend to his own business and win. That was pure Zátopek, though. Races for him were like a pub crawl. He loved competing so much that instead of tapering and peaking, he jumped into as many meets as he could find. During a manic stretch in the late 40s, Zátopek raced nearly every other week for 3 years and never lost, going 69-0. Even on a schedule like that, he still averaged up to 165 miles a week in training. Zátopek was a bald, self-coached 30-year-old apartment dweller from a decrepit Eastern European backwater when he arrived for the 1952 Olympics in Helsinki. Since the Czech team was so thin, Zátopek had his choice of distance events, so he chose them all. He lined up for the 5,000 meters and won with a new Olympic record. He then lined up for the 10,000 meters and won his second gold with another new record. He'd never run a marathon before, but what the hell? With two golds already around his neck, he had nothing to lose, so why not finish the job and give it a bash? Zátopek's inexperience quickly became obvious. It was a hot day, so England's Jim Peters, then the world record holder, decided to use the heat to make Zátopek suffer. By the 10-mile mark, Peters was already 10 minutes under his own world record pace and pulling away from the field. Zátopek wasn't sure if anyone could really sustain such a blistering pace. "Excuse me," he said, pulling alongside Peters. "This is my first marathon. Are we going too fast?" "No," Peters replied. "Too slow." If Zátopek was dumb enough to ask, he was dumb enough to deserve any answer he got. Zátopek was surprised. "You say too slow," he asked again. "Are you sure the pace is too slow?" "Yes," Peters said. Then he got a surprise of his own. "Okay, thanks." Zátopek took Peters at his word and took off. When he burst out of the tunnel and into the stadium, he was met with a roar, not only from the fans, but from athletes of every nation who thronged the track to cheer him in. Zátopek snapped the tape with his third Olympic record, but when his teammates charged over to congratulate him, they were too late. The Jamaican sprinters had already hoisted him on their shoulders and were parading him around the infield. "Let us live so that when we come to die, even the undertaker will be sorry," Mark Twain used to say. Zátopek found a way to run so that when he won, even other teams were delighted. You can't pay someone to run with such infectious joy. You can't bully them into it either, which Zátopek would unfortunately have to prove. When the Red Army marched into Prague in 1968 to crush the pro-democracy movement, Zátopek was given a choice. He could get on board with the Soviets and serve as a sports ambassador, or he could spend the rest of his life cleaning toilets in a uranium mine. Zátopek chose the toilets. And just like that, one of the most beloved athletes in the world disappeared. At the same time, coincidentally, his rival for the title of world's greatest distance runner was also taking a beating. Ron Clark, a phenomenally talented Australian with Johnny Depp's dark, dreamy beauty, was exactly the kind of guy that Zátopek, by all rights, should hate. While Zatopek had to teach himself to run in the snow at night after sentry duty, the Australian pretty boy was enjoying sunny morning jogs along the beaches of Mornington Peninsula and expert coaching. Everything Zatopek could wish for, Clark had to spare. Freedom, money, elegance, hair. Ron Clark was a star, but still a loser in the eyes of his nation. Despite breaking 19 records in every distance from the half mile to 6 miles, the bloke who choked never managed to win the big ones. In the summer of 68, he blew his final chance. In the 10,000-meter finals at the Mexico City Games, Clark was knocked out by altitude sickness. Anticipating a barrage of abuse back home, Clark delayed his return by stopping off in Prague to pay a courtesy call to the bloke who never lost. Toward the end of their visit, Clark glimpsed Zatopek sneaking something into his suitcase. "I thought I was smuggling some message to the outside world for him, so I did not dare to open the parcel until the plane was well away," Clark would say. Zatopek sent him off with a strong embrace. "Because you deserved it," he said, which Clark found cute and very touching. The old master had far worse problems of his own to deal with, but was still playful enough to grant a victory stand hug to the young punk who'd missed his chance to mount one. Only later would he discover that Zatopek wasn't talking about the hug at all. In his suitcase, Clark found Zatopek's 1952 Olympic 10,000 meters gold medal. For Zatopek to give it to the man who'd replaced his name in the record books was extraordinarily noble. To give it away at precisely the moment in his life when he was losing everything else was an act of almost unimaginable compassion. His enthusiasm, his friendliness, his love of life shone through every movement, an overcome Ron Clark said later. "There is not, and never was, a greater man than Emil Zatopek." So here's what Coach Vigil was trying to figure out. Was Zatopek a great man who happened to run, or a great man because he ran? Vigil couldn't quite put his finger on it, but his gut kept telling him that there was some kind of connection between the capacity to love and the capacity to love running. The engineering was certainly the same. Both depended on loosening your grip on your own desires, putting aside what you wanted and appreciating what you got, being patient and forgiving and undemanding. Sex and speed. Haven't they been symbiotic for most of our existence, as intertwined as the strands of our DNA? We wouldn't be alive without love. We wouldn't have survived without running. Maybe we shouldn't be surprised that getting better at one could make you better at the other. Look, Vigil was a scientist, not a swami. He hated straying into this Buddha under the lotus tree stuff, but he wasn't going to ignore it either. He'd made his bones by finding connections where everyone else saw coincidence, and the more he examined the compassion link, the more intriguing it became. Was it just by chance that the pantheon of dedicated runners also included Abraham Lincoln? He could beat all the other boys in a foot race. And Nelson Mandela, a college cross-country standout who even in prison continued to run 7 miles a day in place in his cell. Maybe Ron Clark wasn't being poetic in his description of Zatopek. Maybe his expert eye was clinically precise. His love of life shone through every movement. Yes, love of life, exactly. That's what got Vigil's heart thumping when he saw Juan and Martimano scramble happy-go-luckily up that dirt hill. He'd found his natural-born runner. He'd found an entire tribe of natural-born runners, and from what he'd seen so far, they were just as joyful and magnificent as he'd hoped. Vigil, an old man alone in the woods, suddenly felt a burst of immortality. He was onto something. Something huge. It wasn't just how to run. It was how to live. The essence of who we are as a species and what we're meant to be. Vigil had read his Lumholtz, and at that moment the great explorer's words revealed their hidden treasure. So that's what Lumholtz meant when he called the Tarahumara the founders and makers of the history of mankind. Perhaps all our troubles, all the violence, obesity, illness, depression, and greed we can't overcome, began when we stopped living as running people. Deny your nature, and it will erupt in some other, uglier way. Vigil's mission was clear. He had to trace the route back from what we've become to what the Tarahumara have always been and figure out where we got lost. Every action flick depicts the destruction of civilization as some kind of crash-boom-bang, a nuclear war or hurtling comet or a self-aware cyborg uprising. But the true cataclysm may already be creeping up right under our eyes. Because of rampant obesity, 1 in 3 children born in the United States is at risk of diabetes, meaning we could be the first generation of Americans to outlive our own children. Maybe the ancient Hindus were better crystal ball gazers than Hollywood when they predicted the world would end not with a bang, but with a big old yawn. Shiva the Destroyer would snuff us out by doing nothing, lazing out, withdrawing his hot-blooded force from our bodies, letting us become slugs. Coach Vigil wasn't a maniac, though. He wasn't proposing we all run off to the canyons with the Tarahumara to live in caves and gnaw mice. But there had to be transferable skills, right? Basic Tarahumara principles that could survive and take root in American soil. Because my God, imagine the payoff. What if you could run for decades and never get injured, and log hundreds of weekly miles and enjoy every one of them, and see your heart rate drop and your stress and anger fade while your energy soared? Imagine crime, cholesterol, and greed melting away as a nation of running people finally rediscovered its stride. More than his Olympic runners, more than his triumphs and records, this could be Joe Vigil's legacy. He didn't have all the answers yet, but watching the Tarahumara whisk past in their wizard capes, he knew where he would find them. Chapter 16. Funny, because Shaggy was looking at the same thing, and all he saw was a middle-aged guy with a demonic knee. Shaggy's ear caught the problem first. For hours, he'd been listening to the faint whish, whish, whish of Juan's and Martimano's sandals, a sound like a drummer beating rhythm with the brushes. Their soles didn't hit the ground so much as caress it, scratching back lightly as each foot kicked toward their butts and circled around for the next stride. Hour after hour, whish, whish, whish. But as they came down Mount Elbert on the single-track trail toward mile 70, Shaggy detected a little hitch in the beat. Martimano seemed to be babying one foot, placing it carefully rather than whipping it right around. Juan noticed too. He kept glancing back at Martimano uncertainly. ¿Qué pasa? Shaggy asked. What's up? Martimano didn't answer right away, most likely because he was mentally scanning the previous 12 hours to see if he could pinpoint the cause of his pain. Was it running those 13 miles wearing trail shoes for the first time in his life? Or pivoting around those jagged switchbacks in the dark? Or slip-sliding over slick stones in a raging river? Or was it La Bruja, Martimano said. Must have been the witch. The whole episode back at the firehouse suddenly made sense. Anne's glare, the mumbo-jumbo she spat at him, the shocked look on people's faces, Kitty's refusal to repeat it in English, Shaggy's comment. It was obvious. Anne had cursed him. I passed her, Martimano said later, but then she cast a spell on my knee. Martimano had been afraid something like this would happen ever since the Pescador had refused to bring along their shaman. Back home in the Barrancas, the shamans protect the Isquiate and Pinole from witchcraft and combat any spells in the runners' hips and knees and butts by massaging them with smooth stones and mashed medicinal herbs. But the Tarahumara had no shaman by their side in Leadville, and look what happened. For the first time in 42 years, Martimano's knee was giving out. When Shaggy realized what was going on, he felt a sudden pang of affection. "They're not gods," he realized. "They're just guys." And like every guy, the thing they loved most could bring them the most misery and confusion. Running 100 miles wasn't painless for the Tarahumara either. They had to face their doubts and silence the little devil on their shoulder who kept whispering excellent reasons in their ear for quitting. Shaggy looked over at Juan, who was torn between taking off or sticking with his mentor. "Go ahead," Shaggy told Juan in his pacer. "I've got your boy. Go run that bruja down like a deer." Juan nodded and soon disappeared around a bend in the trail. Shaggy gave Martimano a wink. "It's tu y yo, amigo." "Guadajuco," Martimano said. "Cool by me." The scent of the finish line was tickling Anne's nose. By the time Juan made it to the Half Moon aid station at mile 72, Anne had nearly doubled her lead. She was 22 minutes ahead, with just 28 miles to go. Just to pull even, Juan would have to steal back close to 1 minute every mile, and he was about to enter the worst possible place to start trying, a 7-mile stretch of asphalt. Anne, with her road racing expertise and air-injected Nikes, could uncoil her long legs and let fly. Juan, who'd never touched blacktop until that day, would have to handle the strange surface in homemade sandals. "His feet are really going to suffer," Juan's pacer called out to a TV crew by the roadside. As soon as Juan came off the dirt and hit the hardtop, he bent his knees and shortened his stride, getting all the shock absorption he needed from the up-and-down compression of his legs. He adjusted so well, in fact, that his amazed pacer began falling back, unable to keep up. Juan chased Anne on his own. He covered the 7 miles to the fish hatchery in almost exactly the time it had taken him that morning, then cut left and on to the muddy trail leading to the dreaded Powerline climb. Many Leadville runners fear Powerline nearly as much as Hope Pass. "I've seen people sitting by the side of the trail crying," one Leadville vet recalled. But Juan leaned into it like he'd been waiting for it all day, running up near-vertical pitches that force most runners to push their knees down with their hands. Ahead, Anne was approaching the peak, but her eyes were nearly closed with exhaustion, as if she couldn't bear to even look at the last bit of slope. Switchback by switchback, Juan steadily reeled her in, until abruptly he pulled up short and started hopping on one foot. Disaster had struck. The thong on one of his sandals had snapped, and he had nothing to replace it with. As Anne was cresting the mountain, Juan was taking a seat on a rock and examining what was left of the strap. He rethreaded the sandal and found there was just enough thong left to hold the sole on his foot. He knotted the shortened strap carefully and gave it a couple of test steps. Good to go. Anne, meanwhile, had made it to the home stretch. All she had left was the 10 miles of rolling dirt trail around Turquoise Lake before the screams of the Sixth Street party animals hauled her uphill to the finish line. It was just past 8 in the evening, and the woods around her were sinking into darkness, and that's when something burst out of the trees behind her. It came on her so fast, Anne couldn't even react. She froze in place in the middle of the trail, too startled to move, as Juan darted to her left with one stride and back onto the trail with the next, his white cape swirling around him as he whisked past Anne and disappeared down the trail. He didn't even look tired. It's like he was just having fun. Anne was so crushed, she decided to quit. She was less than an hour from the finish line, but the Tarahumara joyfulness that so excited Joe Vigil had totally disheartened her. Here she was, absolutely killing herself to hold the lead, and this guy looked like he could have snatched it any time he pleased. It was humiliating. She now realized that as soon as she'd sprung her queen's gambit, Juan had marked her for the kill. Her husband eventually got her moving again, and just in time. Martimano and the rest of the Tarahumara pack were coming up fast. Juan crossed the finish line in 17 hours and 30 minutes, setting a new Leadville course record by 25 minutes. He also established another first by shyly ducking under the tape instead of breasting it, never having seen one before. Anne finished nearly a half hour later, in 18 hours and 6 minutes. Right behind her, Mart DiMano and his bewitched knee finished third, with Manuel Luna and the rest of the Tarahumara charging home in 4th, 5th, 7th, 10th, and 11th. "Wow, what a race!" Scott Tinley raved for the TV audience as he pushed a microphone into Anne Trason's face. She blinked into the camera lights, looking like she was about to faint, but managed to rally one last burst of fight. "Sometimes," she said, "it takes a woman to bring out the best in a man." "Hey, and right back at you," the Tarahumara could have replied. Thanks to Anne's heroic attempt to single-handedly defeat an entire team of distance-running savants, she had smashed her own Leadville best by more than 2 hours, setting a new women's record that has never been broken. But the Tarahumara weren't free to say anything at the moment, even if they'd been so inclined. They'd stepped off the race course and into a shitstorm. This should have been their moment. Finally, after centuries of horror and fear, after being hunted for their scalps, enslaved for their strength, and bullied for their land, the Tarahumara were respected. They had proven themselves, indisputably, the greatest ultra-runners on Earth. The world would see they had fantastic skills worth studying, a way of life worth preserving, a homeland worth protecting. Joe Vigil was already selling his house and quitting his job. That's how excited he was. Now that Leadville had built a bridge between American and Tarahumara culture, he was ready to carry out a plan he'd been contemplating for a long time. At 65 years old, he was ready to retire from Adams State anyway. He and his wife, Carolyn, would move to Arizona's Mexican border, where he'd set up a base camp for Tarahumara studies. It might take another few years, but in the meantime, he'd come back to Leadville every summer and tighten his relationship with the Tarahumara racers. He'd start learning their language, get them on a treadmill with heart rate and maximal oxygen consumption monitors, maybe even arrange workshops with his Olympians. Because that was the cool part. Anne had been right there with them, which meant whatever the Tarahumara were doing, the rest of us could learn. It was beautiful. For about a minute. "If you think you're using one goddamn picture of my Tarahumara," Rick Fisher declared when Tony Post and the other Rockport executives hurried over with their congratulations, "you'd better come up with some money." "But 5,000 bucks." "But you've already been paid, Rick. We lived up to our deal and 5,000. Or you can forget showing that film." Tony Post was appalled. He really went off. He came across like he was totally enraged, like the kind of guy who'd hunt you down and kill you. Not literally, Post hastened to add. He just seemed like this hothead who would argue forever and never admit he was wrong.
"He was a pain in the ass," Ken Klober added.
According to Ken, Fisher demanded that Rockport come up with an extra $5,000 bonus for the Tarahumara instantly.
"He wasn't a pain in the ass until we had big-time sponsors and TV crews, and then he held Rockport hostage to use film of the Indians. He tried to make life miserable for me as the race president. He was totally self-serving, and he didn't take care of them at all."
That's how steamed Klober was, and the worst was yet to come. Fisher still had one last bomb to drop.
"They had a blonde, blue-eyed female they wanted to win, and she didn't win," Fisher would say.
Pushed into a corner, Fisher fought back by going sort of nuts, just the way he had that time when he was surrounded by drug thugs in the Copper Canyons and only survived by going berserk. Accusing Ken and Rockport of favoring Anne Trason made no sense at all, but it accomplished one goal. It got people yelling about something besides the $5,000 he was demanding. The Tarahumara watched the Chabochis scream at each other. They heard the angry words and saw the angry arms chopping in their direction. The Tarahumara didn't know what was being said, but they got the message.
Confronted by hostility, the world's greatest underground athletes reacted as they always had. They headed back home to their canyons, fading like a dream and taking their secrets with them. After their triumph in 1994, the Tarahumara would